NDPA presents the Water Safety Champion Podcast.
All right, everyone, welcome back to episode 3 of, I guess, season 2 of the NDPA Water Safety Champions Podcast. I'm Adam Ketchmarchi, the executive director at NDPA, and always joined by my guest host, my esteemed guest co-host, Alyssa Magro.
Thank you.
Yeah, Alyssa, when I think of you, the word esteem does come to mind. So take Thanks. That for what you wish. But Alyssa, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic. I'm happy to be here. I'm ready for this conversation.
Yeah, I'm really excited. Today's podcast guest is Dr. Stephen Langendorfer. And I'm just going to go ahead and welcome Dr. Langendorfer. Steve, how are you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing well. Alyssa, I'm kind of excited to be here and to have a chat with you guys and talk a little bit about water stories and water safety stories.
Yeah. So, well, Dr. Langendorfer, I at least consider you a very famous person in water safety. And maybe that's because I have spent years studying the scholarship side of water safety, and I'm quite familiar with your work and your role both at Bowling Green and with the International Journal of Aquatic Education and Research. So let's dive right into the discussion. And as we all know, we like to start off this discussion with, you know, really learning a little bit about your water story. You know, what's your background? What kind of got you involved in a water-centric lifestyle?
Sure. Well, I had the wonderful great fortune of growing up in Western New York State in the Finger Lakes, where there is lots and lots of water. The Finger Lakes are, you know, it's just, it is a drop dead gorgeous area, which makes me always wonder, how did I get stuck out here in the flatland in Ohio? But that was a career choice. But I'm the oldest of 8 children in an Irish-German family. Cool. And my dad was self-taught, at least by the stories that he used to tell. There was a swimming hole. I grew up in a little village called Bath, New York. And there is a river that runs through the valley where Bath is. It's called the Cohocton River. It runs into the Chemung River, which runs into the Susquehanna River, which runs into Chesapeake Bay. And so
that's a lot of rivers, by the way.
It's a lot of rivers.
A lot of rivers.
There was a swimming hole that he used to talk about where they had a rope swing or something. And he and a bunch of guys used to go over and swing and, swing on the rope and drop into the water. And he said, I didn't know how to swim, but everybody was swinging on the rope. And one of the older kids would pull him to shore. And he said, and one day everybody left and I swung out on my own. And it was either sink or swim. And so somehow he got himself back to shore, which helps educate my water safety story a little bit, you know, down the road, in the notion that even though swimming lessons are, you know, something that we all value, there's something about what the individual puts into their experience. And that has helped me recognize that it isn't always what the teacher does, but it's what the swimmer themselves kind of puts in it.
You a question about what you mean by what they put into it? Does that mean, are you meaning what they bring to it in terms of their own experience with water, or what their effort is in
actually both? Yeah. It's what they bring into it as part of their experience, but also what they do to this.
Got it.
And So it was really interesting. Both of my parents were self-taught, and all of my siblings and I were very, very fond of the water. And we would spend weekends. My dad always had a truck, and somehow the eight of us would either fit in cold weather, we would fit in the cab somehow. Or those were the days when you were, you know, this was before seatbelts. That's how old I am. that we would ride in the back of the truck. And in the summer months, one of the things we did on weekends is we would go hunting for swimming holes in the little creeks and everything. And we have a family rule number one growing up is that never, ever go anywhere without your swimsuit. Because you never know when my dad was going to find this swimming hole. He had worked for Bell Telephone after World War II. He was in the Marines in the South Pacific and on Guadalcanal. And then when he became a civilian again, he worked for Bell Telephone. He installed most of the telephones in and around our county there in Western New York. And so he was on the road a lot, and he knew every back road and every little creek and stuff. So he would always find a swimming hole, and we would all go in. There was always one of the eight kids, at least, who's going, "What? I didn't bring my swimsuit." Yeah. And so they either had to go in their underwear or not swim. And so most of the choice was, well, I'm going to have wet underwear because I'm not swim. And so we were really strong, advocates of just having fun and playing in the water. On the flip side of it, my mother had grown up closer to Buffalo, New York, and she was very much enamored of the Finger Lakes. And so she would take us down to Cuca Lake, which is the one that's closest to Bath. It's about 7 miles away. Mm-hmm. And she was the one that made sure we got swim lessons. So from the time we were about five or six up until I actually didn't get my beginner card until I was 10 years old. That's despite having had lessons and probably being very adept in the water, but it was something that later on in life I helped kind of revise the fact that the beginner course was probably a little too comprehensive and too hard. Mm-hmm. It needed to, we needed to break it down a little bit more so that it was an easier progression. So and that was largely based on my own experience. So of course we had all this experience from sometime probably April through September, we would be, swimming places. It wasn't until I was in Boy Scouts when I was probably 11 or 12 that I was ever in an indoor swimming pool. There was one down in Corning, New York at the YMCA, I think. We got to go to that once, and I thought, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen in my life. And then our local school district had a building campaign. They expanded the high school, and they installed a swimming pool. Wow. While I was in eighth grade. And one of my fondest memories is at noon hour, that half hour that you had for lunch today, Adam, we would eat, and then we got to go outside, and there was a hill by the side of behind the high school. Mm-hmm. It was actually junior high. So I'm in eighth grade, and I would climb up the side of that low hill and sit there and watch them build this swimming pool.
Oh,
it was, I, it, you know, again, I'd only been in one indoor swimming pool in my life, and I thought, this is the coolest thing. And so then, you know, the pool opened when I was a freshman, a first year, and they hired a former Navy person. He also went to Ithaca College as a gymnast. His name was Ev Kiff, and he was going to be the swim coach. And Ev had a meeting for anybody who was interested in the swim team, and he said he was going to put a priority when he built the swim team. He was going to put a priority on freshmen and sophomores, you know. And I perked up like, oh, good. So I went home and told my mother I'm going to try out for the swim team. And at that point in time, we only had a high school, a varsity swim team. There wasn't a JV or anything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my mother always thought I was too big for my britches sometimes. And she goes, now, I don't want you to be too disappointed, but you're only a freshman. You're not going, you know, the chance that you're going to get on the swim team this year, you know. And sure enough, you know, Ev was as good to his word. He took every single freshman and sophomore. And in fact, for his entire career, he had hundreds of wins over the time when he was coaching. And he coached all of my brothers as well. This, again, is pre-Title IX. So the girls got to do a little bit of synchronized swimming, but they never had really a high school a swim team.
I won't take offense to that.
But they hold that over my head even to this day. All four of my sisters do. Ev always was of the mind that, in knowing enough about growth and development, that he would not cut a swimmer until they were a junior. And he always kept all the freshmen and sophomores, and they would cut themselves if they weren't, you know, good enough swimmers. If they couldn't keep up in he would let them stay, but they needed to, you know, just persevere. Mm-hmm. And the only time that I know of someone who was going to get cut off the team was when I was already in college. I came home and I would swim at Thanksgiving and at the Christmas break with the high school team before I went back to college. My brother Pete, who is short and stocky and muscular, and had a near drowning experience when he was a kid. And he dutifully, you know, because he's a Langendorfer and he's got to try out for the swim team. So he stuck it out for the 2 years. And Ev told me, he said, I hate to tell you this, but I'm going to have to cut your brother because he's just, you know, he's a junior now and he's not making it.
Yeah.
And just after, you know, Ev was just beside himself because he didn't want to do this. And there was apparently a knock on his office door. And here's my brother, Pete. He goes, Coach Kiff, I don't want you to be mad at me, but I'm going to go out for wrestling. And Ev Kiff said to him, well, Pete, you know, I think you got to do what you've got to do. And I won't hold
that's it. That's funny.
So he got off the hook. And to this day, I hope my brother doesn't listen to this podcast.
Because he doesn't know. That's
to funny. This day, I've never told the story that he was about to get cut.
I gotta say, Steve, what's so funny about this. So Alyssa and I, in episode one of the podcast, share both of our water safety stories, our water stories. And you know what's so funny? I was the exact opposite. Like I was basically your brother, right? Stocky, you know, muscular. I was a power lifter, football player. and a wrestler, and then I decided to do my first lifeguarding class. And I will tell you, that was back when it was the 500 yard swim, and
exactly, right? Oh yeah.
And I persevered. I did all 500 yards and did not stop. And the instructor of the class is standing over me, and he goes, "Oh, I don't know about this." And I'm like, "Come on, man, I'll work hard, right?" But yeah, we tend to not do well hydrodynamically in the water.
Yes. Yes. So anyway, that's the beginning of my story. As it turns out, that first year, I was the high point winner as a freshman. And I think I was probably for the first 3 years of the swim team. And then there was one of the other guys that was a couple years younger than me. I'm pretty sure he probably outpointed me by the time we went. And I also remember the very first swim meet we were in. I had never seen a swim meet. I think maybe once in a while it had been broadcast on TV or something, but I didn't really know anything about it. So here we are going to this swim meet. And Ev tried to kind of prepare us, but he'd never been to a swim meet either. He was a gymnast. And so we went to this little town called Andover, New York, and it had a 4-lane 20-yard pool, like an old YMCA. Yeah. And so, of course, to swim the 100, you had to swim 5 lengths. And, you know, that was like, you might as well have been trying to swim a mile, you know, for us. And on the very first race, I got up and I ended up taking a second place in the race. It was a 200. The 200 freestyle has always been the race that I always do. It's a, you know, it's a long sprint, and it's my worst event always. And then we got out, and it turns out that, you know, poor little Andover was a little tiny place. I don't know. They may have had, you know, 10 people on the swim team. And so we just kind of overpowered them. We won this first meet. But I still remember getting up for the 100 freestyle. And there was another guy who had come. He had moved to our town, and he'd been in Hawaii. So he's this hotshot swimmer and stuff, but he had a bad habit. Take your marks. And he didn't stop moving. And he was disqualified at that first one. And so here I am, the lone person standing there for our team. And I won that 100 freestyle that first time. And I remember coming home, and my mother said, "So how did it go?" And I go, "We won." And I still remember the look on her face, like, "You what? You won?" My mother, to her credit, never missed another swim meet, at least a home swim meet. She would go to every swim meet. She's a person that, you know, doesn't know anything about sports, but she said, "But I know about swimming. I can always... I know the rules of swimming because you boys have done this." And so she was always a big supporter. So I ended up graduating, had no idea what I wanted to do, except I had gotten a card in the mail when I was probably a junior from a guy by the name of Jack Bame, who was the coach at SUNY Cortland. And so I thought, well, I'll go to Cortland and maybe I can be on the swim team. But I graduated with a full, what's called a region scholarship. So it cost me nothing for tuition at that point. This was when universities were actually well funded. Tuition was $400 a year, and the region scholarship covered the entire thing, and books might have been less than $100 for, you know, a semester. So I could make enough in the summer lifeguarding and working at summer camp and those kinds of things in Boy Scouts, that I could support myself in college, knowing that, you know, my parents were sitting there thinking, how are we going to get 8 kids through college on a blue collar salary? But I went to Cortland, and Cortland's what's now known as a Division III, which was
I played him in soccer in the Final Four in college.
Oh, you did? What what school, Alyssa?
I went to Mary Washington College, which is now the University of Mary Washington in Fredericksburg, Virginia.
Oh, cool. But
yeah, SUNY Cortland played him.
Oh, Cortland's it's just an athletic powerhouse. Well, get this, I didn't know what I wanted to do, and I was ranked fourth in my class academically, and I decided to be a physical education major. And everybody's just shaking their heads like, you're a smart person, why do you want to be a physical education major? And I said, I don't know what else I want to do. And so then I tried out for the swim team, and we didn't have a huge number of guys, probably a dozen or 15, and made the team. And that first year when I was a freshman, I was an early, like in November, we were doing some preseason training, and we had an all-American swimmer from Long Island on the team. Bob and I are still real close friends. He's living in Cortland now, and Bob hated to train. I mean, he's just naturally fast swimmer, and he's an IMer, and so one of those early workouts, we were doing like 3 1,000s, and I had never swum that before, but I thought, okay, I'm in college, I guess I've got to do this. So I took off and I started lapping Bob, who was the All-American. And the next thing I know, the coach is pulling me over, and he goes, what did you do in high school? And I said, I was a 100 yard sprinter. He goes, well, we need some long distance people.
Oh,
and,
no.
And, you know, I'm so dumb. I go, oh, okay. And as one of my colleagues who's a coach in Australia said, you have trained all of the fast twitch fibers out of your body. And that's why you got to be a distance swimmer. You just got to go long. So, so I was the first person ever from my high school to go to college and swim on a team. I stayed an extra year because, you know, here I am getting ready to graduate. And I thought, well, everybody goes, oh, you're so smart. Except for my dad. He said, okay, you were fourth in your high school class, and in college, you're fourth in your class. You didn't even improve yourself. You're still a fourth. Well, you know, my dad didn't have a college education, but he's a smart guy, and he was just ribbing me. Mm-hmm. But he wouldn't come to my college graduation because he said, you didn't get any better. Of course, there was 139 of us in our high school class, and there was 1,000 at Cortland graduating.
You got better.
And anyway, he was, you know, he just liked to kind of tease me. So everybody said, oh, you're so smart, you need to go to med school. And so I stayed an extra year at Cortland and got my credentials to be a swimming official. Mm-hmm. And I worked with the new swimming coach who had come in. And we did a bibliography of swimming. So it was the first kind of research I had done, and I did all the work for him, and he published it. He didn't even put my name on it, I don't think. And at that point in time, I didn't know any better. I thought, you know, later on, I thought, that rat, I should have been at least an honorable mention or something on this paper. Because I was a halfway decent student, and I did my senior year, I went to Germany at the German Sports College, the Deutsche Sporthochschule in Cologne, Germany. And the woman there was world famous. Her name was Lisela Diem, and she had done a study of infant swimming, which is still widely recognized. What she did is she exposed, she had the parents take these kids swimming, and then she followed them longitudinally. And in fact, they turned out to, because of their early experience, both in swimming and in gymnastic stuff, these kids were better than the control group that they had. They were academically better, physically better. So she had some evidence that there was something about early experience in swimming. I was captivated by that. So I did a report on it. And one of the professors at Cortland knew about this interest of mine. And I was, you know, I'd graduated, but I was hanging around campus taking calculus and physics and chemistry, just doing abominably with them, which told me, yeah, you don't belong as in med school. And one day I was walking across campus, and this professor drove by and saw me, slams on the brakes and rolls the window down and goes, "In my office this afternoon, I've got a grad assistant for you at Purdue University. And I'll tell you about it when you come to my office." So I'm like, okay, I still didn't know what I wanted to do. Well, she had just come back from the national conference, the AFRD conference, and had talked to several people from Purdue. And one of them was Sally Erbaugh. Sally and I have had parallel careers. She was the women's basketball coach at Cortland while I was there. And then she was an instructor at Purdue. And this is in the old days. Again,
what is defined as the old days? What year are we talking here?
We're talking pre-1972. Okay. So there are men's and women's physical education programs. When I tell my current students, they go, "What? No, there's just a physical education." Oh no. There used to be women's physical education and men's. So both of my graduate degrees are in women's physical education programs because they had the better academic program where they really looked at the different biomechanics and motor development and motor learning and things, where the men's program basically was focused almost entirely on athletic kind of things. So these guys could go out and be either a coach or an athletic director, where the women were trying to really educate people in a particular sub-discipline. So here I go off to Purdue University. I'd never been west of Buffalo, New York, and off to Purdue. And just a side note here, yesterday I went right past West Lafayette on visiting family in Indiana. So it was like, oh, because that's in West Lafayette is where I met my wife. And, you know, it's one of these wild stories. So Purdue University, the women's physical education program, was running what was called the Developmental Movement Education Program. And it was a preschool, what we would probably call a swim and gym program. My major professor was mostly interested in the movement education kinds of things that they were doing in the gym, but she was a pragmatist and realized that really the reason that all of the parents wanted their kids in this program is because then they got swim lessons while they were preschoolers, because this was before the Y or the Red Cross or anybody had swim lessons. And so Sally Erbaugh was the faculty member who was kind of in charge of the water. So Sally and I worked together, and I started out by thinking, okay, this is all well and good, but we're studying in our classes this movement education approach. Shouldn't we be using movement education in the pool? And it's like, you know, Dr. Clifton, who was my major professor and was running this program, you know, the swimming part of it was a lot like the loss leader. You want to get people to come to your store. You have one thing that's really cheap. So, you know, just don't let anybody drown and, you know, let the kids have a good time. But the real educational value she thought was in the movement education in the gym. So we turned the swimming program into a movement education approach. And it was quite successful. Sally went on to use all the data that she collected from the 2 to 4 year olds, and became her PhD dissertation. And then while I had been in Germany, you know, I'd studied with this Liselotte Diem, who had done the infant swimming program. She had introduced us. She had a film of a lady by the name of Myrtle McGraw that she showed us in Germany, and I was I had met my wife, and so I was visiting over the one summer, and Dr. Clifton said, "Well, you're probably are interested in this. This Myrtle McGraw is donating all of her research films on motor development, and some of them are on swimming, the infant swimming reflex, and she's going to be donating them to the University of Wisconsin at Madison, and she's doing it this next weekend. I think you should go to this." So, you know, again, I've never been any place. This is pre Google Maps. I still don't know how I found my way to Madison, but I went to this thing, and I met Myrtle McGraw, and then I met these two other ladies, Lois Halverson and Marianne Robertson, who became my mentors in grad school, and I thought, wow, this is cool. They've got Myrtle McGraw's films and stuff. I think I should go, and once I'd finished my master's degree at Purdue, I should go on and do this PhD program.
So I have a question for you on that. Yeah. This is just, you know, I have to ask, because, you know, I come from, you know, both my parents never were college educated, and, you know, I was a first generation college student, and, you know, much like you, pursued graduate school, you know, went straight through. And I'm curious, you know, what were your parents' thoughts as, you know, you called them and said, "Hey, I did the master's degree, now I'm going to go on for this doctorate degree." I'm just curious to see if they had the same reaction my parents did.
Well, I did leave out one important part of the story is that, I was a master's degree student at Purdue. This sweet young thing that I fell head over heels in love with was a freshman. She was on a scholar. And I'll talk about, she was on scholarship, and the scholarship was only good as long as she was not married.
Oh, wow.
As soon as she got married, they would take her scholarship away. So she had to finish. So I went back to New York and got a job as an aquatic director at a brand new pool in Lansing, New York, and became, I was really hired as a physical education person, but my job was run the pool, be the swim coach. The cool thing about this school district is all three of the schools, the high school, the elementary school, and the middle school, were on the same campus. Mm-hmm. And in building this swimming pool, the superintendent had promised that every kid was going to get to have swim lessons. And so we brought all of the elementary school kids down in the fall with their teacher. Most of the time, the teachers didn't get in the water, but a few of them did. And they had swim lessons all while, you know, the weather was really nice for from September through, you know, late October. And then
every grade level.
But in the fall, it was only the elementary kids. In the winter, it was the high school kids because they didn't have to go out in the weather. And then in the spring, when it got nice again, all of the middle schoolers came up. So every single kid from kindergarten through grade 12 got to get swim lessons. They have this Lansing, New York, to this day, has the most phenomenal swim teams that you ever, because they have continued this.
Yeah, everybody I was going to ask that. I was going to ask if they've continued it. And wow, why aren't we doing that everywhere? Which is probably a conversation we could all three have easily.
Well, right? there is a move afoot right now. There is a commission that's been appointed by the governor of New York to do exactly that. Every child should have the opportunity to get swimming lessons. And I was brought on as a consultant, even though I don't live there anymore, but some people still know of me. So we talked about it. But yeah, that's something that they are hoping to pursue in New York. So anyway, I worked for 3 years, and in my third year, Jean finished her degree in library science, and we got married at Christmas, and she moved out to New York for that spring semester. In the meantime, I applied for graduate school at University of Wisconsin, and we ended up moving there. We were there for 4 years. Now, here's the side story to this. Both Dr. Clifton at Purdue and Dr. Halverson at Wisconsin made me promise that I would be a good academic, you know, in my degree, and I'd give up this swimming stuff.
Uh-oh.
Neither of them, well, they basically had a stereotype for the swimming person, which is, and we all know, you know, aquatic people are pragmatists. They do what works and whatever. But both of these women just looked down their nose at this. And I said, okay, I promise. And I had to do my doctoral dissertation on the overarm throw. And
that's unfortunate. I'm sorry. Yeah. No, I'm just kidding.
I did my master's thesis on this movement education swimming connection, but I couldn't do it. Well, but the first, you know, and here I told Dr. Halverson, okay, I'll do this. The very first paper that I ever published was on swimming. And a number of years later, she said to me, okay, all right, I can tell, you know, this is what you really want to do. So let's do it correctly. You know, let's have a line of inquiry and all of this stuff. So she finally begrudgingly said, you know, I guess you're being successful. You know, you're moving up in the ranks academically, because I went, I started at Kent State as an assistant professor, got promoted to associate professor. Then Dr. Robertson, who was my, she basically was my supervisor for a number of grants that she had. So I learned a lot of the research things and worked under her. She was hired at Bowling Green to be the school director. And Bowling Green's in Northwest Ohio. Kent is in Northeast Ohio. And so she recruited me heavily to move from Kent to Bowling Green, which has, well, Kent basically closed down its swimming teams and everything else. Bowling Green has this phenomenal 50 meter by 25 yard pool that I, you know, I swam in this morning. I swim there every day. And so it was a great move professionally for me because it stayed within the same, retirement system. It's all in the, in Ohio. It wasn't as it turns out, the people that suffered a little bit are my three kids because I moved them when they were in ninth, eighth and sixth grade or something that.
And the formative years, that's rough.
Formative years. And they don't really hold it against me, but they have finally over the years have shared that was the most miserable thing you could have done, Dad. And one of the other faculty at Kent had said, yeah, my dad made the choice and he chose the other way. He stayed at a place where he wasn't really welcome. And so he suffered, but it was the best thing that could have happened for the family. And anyway, well, it was one of those.
It's worked out for you. I mean, you retired from Bowling Green and I know you had a pretty prosperous career there. So,
yeah. And it was, you know, it was a different, Kent is either the second or third largest university in Ohio because they have all these regional campuses and they were growing great guns and they lost a little bit of their soul. And one of the things that Bowling Green did is they've focused really strongly on the undergraduate education and there's just a different sense on campus and there always has been. But and at Bowling Green, I had the opportunity to do more research work and stuff. And then, I knew Reiner Martens and I had published my book with Larry Bruyer, who was one of my classmates at Purdue University, the aquatic readiness book. And Reiner had been wanting to establish a journal in aquatics from the mid 1980s, I think. And then Louise Priest, who led the CNCA, the Council for National Cooperation in Aquatics, had started the National Aquatic Journal, just, you know, on the seat of her pants. She really didn't know anything about editing or whatever, but managed to get, 10 volumes out of her or something. And then after that went under, in the 90s, in the 1990s sometime, Reiner Martens started talking with Tom Lichocki
the National Swimming Pool Foundation.
The National Swimming Pool Foundation, that's right. And who we got to visit with at in Colorado Springs last 2 months ago. It was really great to see him. Anyway, they originally were, they realized that there was a lot of kind of practical kinds of things in the aquatic area. So they wanted to have a journal that did both the scholarly as well as professional articles. So what they were in their discussions, what they were going to do is try to find co-editors of the journal, one person who was a scholar and another person who was an aquatic person, an aquatic professional. And I still remember the phone call from Reiner Martens. What had happened is Reiner had kind of lost track of me. He still thought I was at Kent. And then when he had made inquiries, now they go, Langer was not here, you know. But when he finally caught up with me at Bowling Green, he goes, I thought you were dead or something. I don't know. he said, well, you have solved the problem for us. And I go, what do you mean? He said, we would like you to be the editor. And you have the scholarly credentials. And you're also an aquatic person. So you can handle both.
And you're not dead.
And you're not dead. That's, maybe that should have been first. that really has been probably the contribution editing the International Journal of Aquatic Research and Education has probably been one of the, you know, the peak experiences of my career. And it's, you know, the side benefit is that I keep getting invited all over the world.
That seems good.
Yeah. I mean, I've been to Norway and to all over Europe. I've been to Brazil 3 times and Australia several times, and I'm going back to Perth in December now. It's just been a terrific, I mean, that's basically where people kind of have an understanding of what I do, either through the Aquatic Readiness book or through the International Journal. And it's kind of heady stuff.
I have to say, you know, my doctoral advisor, when I went through, knew you quite well. I don't think she had ever met you or met you maybe one time, but she knew your book, she knew the journal. And you definitely, I mean, I still reference aquatic readiness all the time in my work. I do have a question for you on that, Steve. You know, for the journal, what do you think, I mean, as the editor, you know, who really saw where aquatic scholarship was at prior to the journal's existence, and now, I mean, it's still, you know, really the only place in my mind. I mean, there are some other, you know, journals out there that I've published, and I'm sure you have published,
right,
you know, on the subject, but it's really, I mean, and I treat the aquatics journal specifically as it's one place where both professionals and scholars go, and I think that's the critical piece to that. You know, what have you seen? Have you seen a dynamic shift in scholarship and aquatics over your time? And I also want to ask you, I think some of the most powerful things the journal has produced, or you've been a part of too, is not just the scholar work that you've done, but also the editorial side of the journal, and really, you know, calling or, you know, pointing out things that need to be highlighted in this space.
Well, answering the first question, yes, it is. And I don't know that I want to take credit or the journal take credit, but we certainly have been part of this. The amount of aquatic scholarly work, both, you know, research and as well as the publications, is just phenomenal. You know, we started in 2007. And the first couple of issues, maybe the first 1.5 volumes of this, so 6 issues, we had quite a few editorial or what I call educational or professional articles. It's lucky if we have even 1 or 2 in most issues anymore, because the international scholarship is unbelievable. And I mean, I never, you know, I came into it in 2007 thinking, yeah, we're really going to have to mine all of these aquatic professionals and get them to write articles. They just, you know, there just wasn't. There were a few people that were really into it. But it just, within a year or two of the journal starting, it just went nuts. And yeah. And of course, the best thing that happened, you know, it's sort of, it was sad at the time when I, you know, I got a message from, because Reiner Martens at that point had actually retired, and he was only in an ex officio status at Human Kinetics. But they claimed to me that they lost over $100,000 on the journal because they used a subscription, approach that in order to get the journal, you had to buy a subscription. They never, in its heyday, they never had more than 400 subscribers, including all the you know, libraries and stuff, who are their really meat and potatoes, because they charge them a lot more. And so the best thing that ever happened to the journal was when they said, we just can't publish this anymore. And just coincidentally, here at Bowling Green, the library had acquired a platform from the Berkeley, the University of California at Berkeley Press. So it's called B Press. And this platform is called ScholarWorks. And here's the other, I mentioned earlier, you know, as an undergrad, my wife studied library science. And when we went to Wisconsin, there's a great library program at the University of Wisconsin. So she got her master's in library science there. And she's a working librarian. And she was working at Kent. And she goes, I think you need to talk to the, you know, my colleagues, because this ScholarWorks might be someplace you can use as a publishing venue. And I went to them and said, I have this international journal, and I didn't even have to finish. Yes, we want an international journal to be published out of here. And what's happened is we started with, I think, four or five, you know, kind of homegrown journals, not, you know, international journal wasn't, but that was sort of the leading journal for us. Now there's over a dozen, I was counting the other day, that the English program, cultural studies, ethnic studies, athletic training, exercise science have all created their own little journals and stuff to, you know, kind of to go along with this. But once we started publishing, and the librarians are very strong advocates of open access.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, we don't do any of that, you know, subscription stuff. And also for authors, you know, the publishers all own the copyrights when you publish with a publisher, but with open access, basically the author retains the copyright, which is, you know, as it should be, because it's your intellectual property, and you shouldn't have to sell it off to somebody else. The other nice thing about as it happened, because the university is supporting this ScholarWorks platform, there's, you know, we don't have a budget, you know, because I work as a volunteer editor. But as long as the university continues to support this, we've got a home, so we don't have to charge any publishing fees either.
That's because, awesome.
As I say, you know, electrons are free.
Well, so. I think that's actually, I mean, really critical, because, I mean, you know, in teaching research methods, you know, open access sometimes can be dirty words, because, you know, sometimes open access journals aren't, you know, quote unquote, as prestigious as open access journals. But I will tell you, I mean, I think there's been a big dynamic shift that's happened here, because, you know, not just to your point of, you know, the easy access and the authors retaining, you know, access rights. But I mean, I think that's the hardest part is, if, you know, we want to, you know, make this information more accessible to, you know, working professionals, not just scholars, and it kind of gets stuck in an echo chamber. I want to ask a couple other questions here, because I know we're running out of time for the podcast. But one thing I want to ask you, I mean, you know, we could probably go down a number of roads as far as, you know, your career and things, but you've served on the Red Cross Scientific Advisory Council. I know you're still active on SAC. The journal's still active. I always ask, you know, what do you think has been the most, you know, meaningful part of your career? That may be really hard to answer that, but, you know, what gets you up every day and go, you know, gosh, I'm really excited, you know, to do this and keep moving? Because I know you've, you know, technically retired from your faculty post at Bowling Green, but I see you, you know, active as ever in the aquatic space.
Well, I this is one of the things that, you two will both end up finding in retirement. You can be as busy as as you can tolerate, I guess. And I've told lots of people, I've started using the term semi-retired, because I said the only difference is I'm doing, you know, the editorial work. I'm volunteering with, as Adam said, on the Scientific Advisory Council, where we've just had these 3 years of funding from the CDC looking at swim lessons and stuff, which I would have killed for if I'd been a faculty member, hadn't retired. And then all things come in there in its time, I guess. But this is I guess I have a bad habit of not being able to say no, but I always say, you know, I'm really doing the same stuff I used to do. People just don't pay me for it. You know, fortunately I have a really good pension because I just by, you know, dumb luck stayed in the same retirement system. And so I guess that I was just thinking, in my head is part, I guess the theme of my water story here is that it really helps to be lucky. I didn't plan any of this. You know, I'm not a person, you know, when I went to college, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I graduated after 4 years. I had, you know, I was summa cum laude and, you know, had a good academic possibilities, I guess, but I really didn't know what I wanted to do. And I heard this really cool commencement address a whole bunch of years ago, because I go to commencement every time because I'm an announcer for them. This lady said, you know, there's three things that you should do. She was talking to the graduates, but I realized right away that she should have been talking to the freshmen. She said, what you need to do is figure out what gets you up in the morning.
Oh, yep. That's a good question.
And then figure out how to get good at it. And somebody will pay you.
Yep. And that's great advice. Yeah.
Three. And I sat there and I thought, holy cow, that she's talking about me and I'm a faculty.
Perfect.
But, you know, so there's you know, one of my favorite phrases, it's better to be lucky than good.
Yep.
But that's kind of the theme. I've just kind of fallen into stuff. Here's, you know, this professor at Cortland finding a grad assistantship for me out, you know, several states west. And then Dr. Clinton or Dr. Marguerite Clifton, who is my major professor, saying, you know, you really ought to go up and hear this speech by Myrtle McGraw, which was about motor development. And she, of course, had the baby swimming stuff in there, and everything just kind of meshed together in different ways. And when I look back on it, I'm going, oh, yeah. And this is what Dr. Halverson recognized. Well, we want him to do motor development, but he keeps going back to the water.
Keep going back to the water. That seems like a good summary for your story.
I think exactly. It's so, you know, I was never hired other than at Lansing for the 3 years to be the swim coach and aquatic director. In academia, I was always hired because of my credentials in motor development. And I have a fairly substantial number of studies in overarm throwing and that sort of stuff. But, you know, got this sideline that keeps dragging me out there. And, you know, and there is something about the water. I have... I coach the local master swim team, but I do it on the condition that I can swim with them, not from the deck. So I swim every day, 7 days a week, if I can do it. And it's, I don't know, it's sort of a lifeblood.
Yeah.
And it's better to be lucky than good, but do follow, you know, as this commencement address said, you know, figure out what what's your passion? What gets you up in the morning, and figure out how to get good at it. And I guess getting good at it, in my sense, was, you know, I went on for the academic degrees, but I always kept getting drawn back into things enough. So, you know, and then here's Rainer Martens says, we want you to be the editor of this journal. And it's just, I just can hardly believe my luck, I guess, that this is one of those experiences that, and so an answer to that question is, yeah, I think probably between the Scientific Advisory Council for the Red Cross and all the work that I've done with them over well over 40 years now, and editing the journal are the kind of what I would call the peak experiences for me. And they both have to do with, you know, with aquatics and swimming, water safety. And, you know, and I, it's only, partly it's only because of NDPA though, that I try to identify myself as a drowning prevention expert. that very first world conference was called the World Congress on Drowning. And as my colleagues, when I tell them I'm going to this conference on drowning, please don't.
Yeah, right.
They recognize right away, oh yeah, this ought to be a conference on drowning prevention.
Yeah.
It's like an important word.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Steve, I'm going to toss to you a question that we wrap every podcast with. And this is sometimes a difficult question for people to answer, but it could go a number of different ways. So I'm going to hand you a magic wand, and you could change one thing in water safety. You know, it could be globally, it could be within the United States. What's the one thing you would change?
Wow, you're right. That's a tough question.
Yeah.
Well, I guess the thing that I would identify is part of my own little pet peeve is that we diversify our teaching, our pedagogy, our teaching strategies. Right now, in sports, in physical education, and especially in aquatics, there is one method for teaching. And Muska Mastin called it the command style teaching. It's a teacher-centered kind of thing. I sometimes call it tell, show, and do, where the presumption, especially with kids, the presumption is you need to tell them what to do, you need to give them a demonstration, and then they need to copy the demonstration. But we know that that's not how you primarily learn. Yes, kids and adults and stuff do copy what they see, but this gets back to that very first little exchange we talked about. Alyssa, you asked the question. It's learning is constructivist. And if we could get more of the professionals, as many as possible with my magic wand, to understand that that the person is going to learn themselves. You know, this gets me back to my dad's story. They're going to learn themselves if you provide the right scaffolding, is another term that we use in constructivism. You can facilitate it by making it really simple and make it more challenging. Marianne Robertson, my mentor in motor development, described this, and I think it applies in aquatics. She said there's three skills you need as a teacher. You need to be able to assess developmentally. Where are they on this continuum of development? In our case, it's in the water. Where are they? How do you individualize so that you're working with each individual learner here, whether it's a child or an adult or whatever? Even though they come to you in a group, how do you How do you individualize? And the third part is that you need to figure out how do you make a skill or what's what the person is learning, not necessarily what you're teaching, what they're learning. How do you make it simpler if they are having difficulty, or how do you make it more challenging if they are moving forward? So how do you make it easier? How do you make it chart? So three, I love things in threes. They're easy to remember, but, and I think that's the other part of my wand. If I could get swimming instructors particularly to understand that you need to assess the person developmentally, mm-hmm. you need to individualize, and you need to figure out how do you make it easier for them if they're being overly challenged? How do you make it a little harder to help them progress along?
Yeah.
I'm writing that down.
All right, you're allowed to.
Yes, yeah.
And I love that. And I know Alyssa always loves, I always see Alyssa writing things down when she hears things like that. So I love that. That's fantastic. Well, Steve, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. I know we could probably talk for hours. And I say this about every podcast guest. I wish we didn't schedule these for just an hour. But Steve, thank you so much for joining us. And, you know, please, to our listeners, go check out the International Journal of Aquatic Education and Research. Please look up the Red Cross Scientific Advisory Council and the work that they do to help advance water safety and aquatics all across the board. And Steve, thank you for your long career. And I know you're still at it, advancing this space. Thank you, sir. We really appreciate it.
Well, it's been my honor. Thank you.
And if you don't know David Zane, I don't know if you've come across him, but he's a retired epidemiologist here in Austin and one of my favorite retired humans, because he is doing so much in our drowning prevention action team here in Central Texas. Cool. And we work together on a Texas drowning report data, but he is also retired, and I love it because he is full on, you know, giving back to this field. You guys would be, if you haven't met, I'm going to have to make that introduction.
I'm going to have to meet him. I don't believe I've met him. So
yeah.
It was David Zane, right?
David Zane.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Well,
what I love about the Alliance.
It's been my honor. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone at home, for listening to this episode of the NDPA Water Safety Champion Podcast. Tune in next week for our next episode, where we'll be joined by the famous Beth Root of the World Swimming Lesson.
Hey. Awesome. Thanks, all right. Everyone. Thanks, everybody.